Everybody, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm reporting from sunny and warm Denver, Colorado. I've got my partner up in Chicago, Larry Mishkin. How you doing, Larry?
Jim, I'm doing just fine. Thank you. Always great to hear from you. Sitting here in lovely Northbrook, Illinois, where it's a little overcast. And it's been cool, actually, here the last couple of days. It got chilly last night. We had to put a sweater on when we sat outside on the porch. So it was kind of nice, actually. Keep the air conditioning off for a few days. But we're gonna get stuck with it again this weekend. So we're enjoying it while we can. We're going to dive right into it today, Jim, because I know you've got a tight schedule, as does our guest. And for me, at least personally, our guest today is somebody who I just could not be more excited to have on our show. Terry Laban is a guy who I went to the University of Michigan with too many years ago to count. And we ran in the same crowd, always just kind of on the outskirts of each other in the crowd. But I knew that Terry was a fan of a lot of the things that I was, including the Grateful Dead and cannabis. And whereas my journalism career took me to the sports pages, Terry was doing a lot of cartooning and drafting and working for the campus humor magazine and all sorts of fun stuff where he could exhibit his skills and talents. After we graduated from college, Terry kind of morphed into a full-time cartoonist, which he can tell us a little bit more about, and hopefully he will tell us about his days doing some work for Grateful Dead comics and stories that I think involved some of the same guys I used to hang out with. As life would have it, Terry and I wound up living about two blocks away from each other in Chicago in the 1990s, and we each have a son who are the same age, and we're going to school together for a while. So it gave us a chance to really reconnect and spend some more time together. And then Terry often went to Philadelphia. So that's where he'll be, I assume, talking from us today. He's had a very successful career as a cartoonist, including his daily cartoon strip, Edge City, which I think just recently stopped running. Terry, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Nice to see you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while, but you know that these are the kind of things that bring people back together. So it's
I lived long enough to see it, so that's a good thing.
Well, that's exactly what Jim and I say all the time. You know, that who knew 30 years ago that we'd have a podcast sitting around talking about marijuana and the Grateful Dead, and people would be interested in listening. But here we are. So boy, I don't even know where to begin.
Cartooning. What do you want to hear about first?
let's talk about cartooning. You know, I mean, while everybody's off in college, kind of going off in serious directions,
you're drawing. Yeah, you know, I was kind of fortunate early on. I wanted to be a cartoonist from about the age of six, and I couldn't really imagine doing anything else. And I went to art school at the University of Michigan, and they didn't have cartooning there, so I studied graphic design. But I did a lot of work, as you said, for the College Humor magazine, and that kind of got my feet wet. But after college, I traveled for a while, and I came back to Ann Arbor, and I was just really fortunate. I wandered into the local paper right after I moved back because I'd grown up pretty close to there in Detroit, and so that wasn't a far way for me to go. And I was showing them some illustration work, trying to get some freelance stuff, and they said, oh, well, we buy local political cartoons, and we'll pay you $40 a pop or whatever. So I ran home and I drew some stuff up, read the paper, saw what was going on, drew some stuff up, and they bought them. Before long, I was actually able to make a living doing that and other kinds of cartoony type things. So I really didn't have to have another job in my life, and that was really fortunate for me in a way, I guess. I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money, but I could live. And if you're ever able to make a living doing what you want to do, then you're never going to want to do anything else. And that's kind of how it happened. So, but shortly after that, I got involved. I really wanted to do comics, so I got involved in the underground, or well, they weren't underground, the alternative cartoonist scene that was really kind of taking off back then. It was really based in Seattle around a company called Fantagraphics. And I ended up creating a couple series for Fantagraphics books, Unsupervised Existence and Cud. And through that, I got involved in the comics industry, did a lot of writing for DC Comics, did another series called Cud Comics for another company called Dark Horse Comics. And so that was my life for about 10 or 15 years before I started into the comic strip. That was a pretty exciting time. I wanted to be an underground cartoonist. That was really my inspiration, but there weren't underground cartoonists by the time I got to it. So it was this whole new thing. And that led me in some interesting and unexpected directions. But during that time, in the mid-1990s, I got to know Dennis Kitchen, who's the publisher of a company called Kitchen Sink Comics, which was a pretty well-known underground outfit. It's a little bit of a latecomer to the underground scene, started in the early 70s to mid-70s. Published a lot of the well-known sort of second string people, and also some anthologies like Death Rattle and stuff that really you'd have to be a pretty underground comics geek to know about it. But it was a pretty big company. And I got to know him. I actually went up to his place in Wisconsin at one point with a bunch of other cartoonists. That was really interesting and fun. But I heard sometime, it must have been around like 1992, 1993, that he had a deal to do Grateful Dead comics. And I really liked the Grateful Dead. And I had no idea what this thing was, but I saw him at a convention around that time. And I went up to him and I said, "Hey, Dennis, I heard you're doing Grateful Dead comics. I really like the Grateful Dead. And I'd love to do some comics about going to the Grateful Dead." And he was receptive to the idea. And he checked with his people or whoever, and they approved it. And I ended up doing probably four or five of them for the various issues. But the funny thing was that it turned out that the comic series was actually, I was the only one that was doing stuff like that. The comic series was actually pretty much people illustrating Grateful Dead song lyrics. So I was the only one doing these kind of stories about going to concerts, which was really, it was kind of interesting for me, and it was a really cool gig. And from time to time, I will meet people who say, you know, they saw my work in Grateful Dead comics. So that's my touch of sort of being involved with the Grateful Dead. And I was in the first issue too. So when they did a collection, my very first story was in there. So that's how that happened. And you know, it was fun because I could put, you know, I put people that we both know in the comics because they were based on going to concerts with those people. Although most of the stories after the first one were pretty much fictional.
How long did Grateful Dead comics run?
It probably wasn't more than a couple of years. I don't think it went more than five or six issues.
It officially authorized by the band?
Yeah, absolutely it was authorized by the band. It was a deal with the Grateful Dead, and Jerry Garcia wrote the introduction, or man, I think there may have been a couple introductions, but Jerry Garcia wrote the introduction to the collection, the one collection they put out, which was
Jerry was always sketching.
Yeah, I know. He was a visual artist, and apparently, I mean, according to him in the introduction, he also really liked comics. And I mean, underground comics were a huge part of his scene, so you know, that's not a surprising thing.
Well, right. It's interesting you mentioned that, and I think that also kind of ties in nicely with the show, certainly in a lot of the comics that I've read that you've drawn, but that other people of the underground comic scene that I'm familiar with, Fat Freddy and the Fabulous Freak Brothers and all of them, marijuana always played a central role in those cartoons. Was that because they were designed to be counterculture and that was just kind of a counterculture thing, or was it just, you know, creating the characters that way?
Well, I mean, I think it was both things, and plus they were designed to be read stoned. I mean, it was entertainment for high people. I mean, that was part of the point. So you had a lot of weird stuff that it really doesn't make sense today, but I guess it did back then, and it did to us. I mean, I encountered that stuff really as a college student in the early 1980s. So it was, the scene was gone, but you know, we were still reading it, those things. And, you know, we were still getting it, but I mean, it was both things, right? I mean, the Freak Brothers was meant to satirize, you know, it was like a hippie version of the Three Stooges. I mean, that was its intent. So it was both talking about stuff that everybody was thinking about at the time, which was dope. I mean, people in the '60s basically thought about dope and being against the war and radical politics, you know, not necessarily at the same time, but and music, and you know, that's what that was, the, and sex, and that was the main subject matter of underground comics, and of course, acid was a huge thing as well in the mix.
Jim, one of Terry's collections is a comic strip called Eno and Plum, which he was kind enough to give me a copy of when he was still in Chicago. And tying into what he just said, one of the classic all-time lines by an author writing an introduction to his book is, after giving this whole description of who the main characters are and what they're all about and everything else, the very end it says, and I'm not going to quote it correctly, but something along the lines of, yeah, and one other thing, you know, it helps a lot if you're stoned and sitting in a barber's chair. And so I always loved that line. The getting stoned part was easy, but I could never find the barber's chair, so I'm still searching.
Well, the thing about it was, you know why I wrote that, the context is that when I was a kid, I would go to the barber shop, and the barber had a lot of comics at my barber shop. And he had good comics. I mean, and I'm not like a superhero guy, which is why I eventually had to leave the comic book industry. But like, he had a lot of Donald Ducks, you know, Carl Barks Donald Ducks, which are the classic Donald Ducks. So I used to sit in the barber chair while my hair was getting cut and read Donald Duck comics. It was an immensely pleasurable experience. And I actually ended up spending 14 years writing Donald Duck comics for the company that was publishing them, Egmont, which is a big Danish company. So that was kind of a weird thing. But when I did, you know, in Plum, it was kind of, in a way, I was thinking of what would you want to read in the like stoner barber chair, I guess. Sure. I mean, they weren't, you know, it wasn't really about hippie culture. It was more about Generation X stuff, but they had a lot of hippie culture woven in.
Right. Absolutely.
So what are you doing today, Terry?
Well, I did a syndicated comic strip called Edge City, as Larry says, for 15 years, and that ended in 2015. So since then, I've gotten into this thing called graphic recording. I go to meetings and events and workshops and seminars, and I take visual notes using markers on large format paper or board as the event happens. So I'm kind of like a living whiteboard video. Did you ever see one of those videos where the hand draws things out as somebody's talking? I do that in real life, in an improvisatory manner, right? So at the end, you have this piece. So it's actually a business. Like, there's people that do this, and they pay, like, big money. unfortunately, as you may expect, you know, I was devastated by the coronavirus thing because people are no longer gathering in conferences and seminars. So that was really a drag. And you can see my stuff at www.breakthroughvisuals.com.
Excellent. Well, that was going to be our next question. No, and we would have. Absolutely. That's part of our show. We want to make sure that people can get in touch with you. And really quickly here, just while we have you, to be able to segue into the marijuana side of things for a minute. You grew up in Pittsburgh, as I recall.
No, I grew up in suburban Detroit.
Oh, suburban Detroit. My bad. Okay. Yeah. Well, there
my
you go.
My mom's from Pittsburgh.
Okay. Well, maybe that's what I was thinking about. So suburban Detroit. And, you know, while you were growing up in suburban Detroit in the late 70s, you know, early 80s, you know, at least in your high school and your community, was marijuana a big thing?
It was for me. yeah, marijuana was a big thing. And I mean, anybody who went to school in the late 70s, you know, I read a statistic like 12% of kids in 1978 were daily marijuana users. I was among those people. And there was a big marijuana culture in my school. And, you know, that was a time, you know, this was before the war on drugs. And that was a time when you could go to any suburban strip mall and find a headshot. I mean, you could, there was a kiosk at our local mall that sold bongs. And, you know, it was really very out in the open compared to what you would have seen 5 years later. And I felt bad for my parents because they didn't like it at all, as you might expect. And you know, they were surrounded by this culture of, you know, everybody, you know, smoking dope is cool. I really wanted to be like, at a certain point in my life, I really wanted to hang out with the burnouts. I wasn't a burnout, you know. They were like kids that were in trouble, and I wasn't so much in trouble, although marijuana got me in a little bit of trouble. But you know, I was really attracted to that sort of, I didn't like my school like a lot of people, and I was really attracted to that scene. But I mean, I have to say that marijuana, you know, really kind of saved my life in a certain kind of way. And I'm really grateful to it because, I had mild OCD growing up. And when I started smoking pot, it cured it, basically. And a lot of the really compulsive behaviors I had, I stopped doing. And, you know, I'm still OCD, but it comes out in a different way. And so even though I would say, you know, and plus my parents didn't like music. I discovered music through pot. You know, the world kind of really, marijuana really opened the world up to me. And, you know, I'm profoundly grateful to it.
Terry, so, when did you start going to Grateful Dead shows?
My first Grateful Dead show was in Ann Arbor in 1979. And, you know, in Detroit, growing up in suburban Detroit, we didn't listen to the Grateful Dead. Like, it wasn't part of our Detroit youth culture at all. Like, you know, people listened to Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, all those 60s bands. Rainbow Band was kind of big when I was growing up. You know, that kind of thing. Ted Nugent was huge in Detroit. You know, and I was really interested in 60s culture. So I would read about, you know, I was really interested in psychedelic music. Like, what is it, you know, and wanting to hear these bands. And at that time, it was very difficult to hear them because they weren't largely playing the stuff on the radio. You had to be a record collector, and you couldn't go on the internet and find this stuff. So I read about the Grateful Dead, like the quintessential acid rock band, right? Like, who are these people? All they would play on the radio is Truckin' and sometimes Casey Jones. And I was like, okay, but that can't be the whole story. And I remember, you know, I went out and I bought their best of, you know, the best of the Grateful Dead on cassette. And I played it, and it was like folk songs or something. It was like, you know, Mexicali blues, like the studio version. And I was like, this is acid rock? I mean, I thought it was going to be like Jimi Hendrix, you know, like a 20-minute Jimi Hendrix jam. Like, what is this stuff? Like, this does not sound psychedelic to me. So it took me, like, when I got to college, I met people who kind of introduced me to the Grateful Dead, and I started, you know, and I took more esoteric drugs and started listening to that music. And, you know, I remember listening to Anthem of the Sun for the first time, and I was just like, oh, okay.
Now I get it.
And Live Dead, I was like, oh yeah, all right, yeah, awesome. And and I don't remember if I heard those things first before I went to the concert, but I remember I went with Jimmy, and I went with Jimmy Marks, our mutual friend, and it's the Grateful Dead's coming to Ann Arbor in the fall of 1979. I was like, oh, let's check it out. So I went with those guys, Steve Stefan, I went with them, all those guys. We went to this concert, and you know, I was on some substances, and wow, you know, like, it was just like, oh my God, like, I realized, like, A, like, okay, this is like what psychedelic music is, and B, like, I really like to dance for like 5 hours, like stoned out of my mind. Like, this is really fun. So after that, then I started to really like the Grateful Dead. I wouldn't call myself a deadhead, you know, like, I hung out with a lot of people that really love the Dead. We would go on, like, they would organize trips on spring break to go wherever the Dead was playing. So I'd always, you know, do you want to come? Yeah, I'll come, you know, and you'd see like 3 or 4 shows, and that was really fun. But, you know, I mean, I've always listened to, you know, I'm kind of a musical archaeologist, and, you know, I listen to, I mean, now, you know, nowadays I like obsessively like download, you know, old psychedelic stuff and prog rock and prog rock, you know, on the internet and whatnot. But that's how I found the Grateful Dead. So
very good.
What's funny about that story, Jim, is 1979, I was still a senior in high school, but a lot of the people that Terry just started naming, guys were who I hung out with throughout my college career and went to a lot of Grateful Dead shows with. And for like all of these guys, except for Jimmy Marks and Steve Stefano, that was their first Dead show. So there's this whole group of guys who saw the Grateful Dead for the first time on campus in Ann Arbor in 1979. And then my luck, I show up in 1980, and the Dead didn't play there again until 1989.
It was 10 years.
Right. And they showed up, and it was funny because they showed up 2 days after Michigan won the national championship, and all the students had rioted and tore stuff down. And
that's right.
Like, right. Everyone was like, this isn't the dead. This isn't the dead. You know, it's So,
set 1979 was also my inaugural year for the Grateful Dead. So I saw one of the last Keith and Donna shows in January of 79 in Springfield, Massachusetts, with my girlfriend at the time, now wife of 40 some years, and Brian, who's still a great friend of mine. And then 5 months later, they played at the UMass football stadium, and it was one of the first Brett Midland shows. So 1979 was my first year as well. And I was a senior.
Big year. And there's at least a couple of people that went to that show that ended up, like, there was one guy, that was his first show, Jim Richmond. There was one guy who ended up becoming, like, you know, the spending, like, 50, the subsequent, like, 15 or 20 years on the road selling T-shirts, like, you know.
Amazing.
Like, dressed, like, had to put in.
I still have a few of his T-shirts because he used to, like, you know, give them a Michigan football theme, which I loved. I would buy them.
I drew one.
Oh, that's so funny. He had you drawn him too. That's great. So, yeah, these are great people names I haven't heard for a while, but right.
I know.
It was such a launch pad for so many people. And
that was his first show. I was like,
right.
Yeah, I thought he was born in like die. Like, you know,
right. Right. That's so funny. That's
as much as we could talk about this all day, we probably should talk a little bit about what's happening in the world of legal marijuana in the last week. Larry, what do you got?
Unfortunately, I got a whole lot of nothing here in Illinois. We're still sitting, you know, in typical frustrating fashion, Terry, just to bring you up to speed on this in 30 seconds or less. Illinois went to adult use this year on January 1st. And the only people who are operating adult use dispensaries and cultivation centers right now are the people that previously had medical marijuana licenses to do so. Mm-hmm. And the idea is now to bring more people in to keep up with the demand and give everybody else a chance. And so we had all these people who prepared applications for dispensaries that were all due on January 1st to announce the winners on April 1st. And then we had another whole group for cultivation that was all due on April 30th to be announced on July 1st. And they still haven't announced the dispensary winners from April 1st. So everybody in Illinois is up in arms because people spend ungodly amounts of money and time putting these applications together, and the state's not making an announcement, and it's creating all sorts of problems if they tried to rebuild property and things like that. And each week we sit here and keep hoping that there's going to be positive news. And unfortunately this week, another week has come and gone and there's nothing new to report. So we're still waiting and keeping our fingers crossed.
Well, it is a shame because, you know, like Hoban Law, Bridge West has cannabis clients all over the country. In spite of, or maybe because of COVID, we're seeing record sales in states from, you know, the East Coast to Hawaii, basically, and everywhere in between. So that's a real shame about Illinois because they're throwing away money hand over fist.
Well, they are, because they still break sales records month after month, but the sales records that they're creating are still limited because the supply is limited and the number of dispensaries is limited. So that, unfortunately, you know, has combined to really kind of take the wind out of the sails here. Everybody was a little surprised because this new governor came in and he was so gung-ho about everything. And now it's all being held up. And of course, that just starts the rumor mill floating around and everybody's got all sorts of crazy ideas as to what's going on. Bribes being paid, or, you know, this is Illinois, so anything is possible. But, you know, we'll see, because you're right. It's crazy for them not to be able to expand and take advantage of this market and what's going on. Terry, the joke that we always have now is, a year ago, nobody would have believed you if you told them that, you know, a year out. So today it would be easier to buy marijuana than toilet paper. But if you live in the right state, it's, you know, it's very true here in Illinois. It's an essential item. So, you know, that was the good news. The governor made sure that the dispensaries can stay open and people can still get what they want or what they need. But we just can't get beyond that to get more of them open. So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. What about you, Jim? What's new? Anything interesting that you're hearing about?
Yeah, well, very busy, getting phone calls from Oklahoma and Arkansas, studying the ballot initiatives for November. You got ballot initiatives in Alabama and Mississippi for medical marijuana. So,
truly is a national trend. I really think we'll catch up with beer and be a $100 billion industry in a few years, is my prediction.
$100 billion legal or $100 billion total?
Well, it's already $100 billion.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. That's true.
So, yeah, I think we'll see the legal markets approaching beer sales.
That's,
you know, and beer sales, enough. I believe, are $110 billion a year.
Just get enough states online and it'll happen. There's marijuana smokers out there waiting to be tapped into.
Yeah, and I work with a lot of cultivators on their business plans, and you know, they're all concerned about, you know, how much should I grow and what can I sell it for? And I said, look, if you grow it, you can sell it.
You pretty know, much.
The only variation is the variable is the price.
Right. I've
seen wholesale prices of in Colorado go from roughly 1,000 to 2,000 year over year. So a year ago, 2019, 1,000 a pound at wholesale, 2,000 a pound, or even higher for top shelf.
Yeah, you know, and we're still getting, kind of a shakeout of what the prices are going to be like here. You know, I noticed that some of the medical dispensaries all of a sudden jacked up their price a little bit because the dirty secret is in a state that has medical and adult use. The adult use, the state tacks on a huge excise tax to make all their money. But if you're a medical patient, you're usually excused from having to pay the excise tax. So as soon as they announce adult use, everybody runs to get their medical cards to avoid it. So now what I'm seeing the dispensaries doing on the medical side is jacking up the price a little bit because they figure we're still going to come in under the adult use. So, you know, maybe, and it's, you know, it's all of a sudden a gram of extract starts costing, you know, $70-$75. Mm. And that's just too much. But, you know, the market's going to have to play itself out. And, you know, we'll see. And I don't know about you, Terry, how much, you know, you get into that these days. But to me, you know, that's the funnest part about it, because for years, marijuana just meant taking some marijuana, rolling a joint, or filling up a bong and taking a hit. And now it means vapes and edibles and tinctures and these extracts, which are like, you know, hashish, but actual resin that they take right off the plant and concentrate to what, Jim, like 85% THC on some of this stuff.
Yeah, very strong.
That the kids dab. I don't know if you're familiar with dabbing or not, but
I don't know what the kids do.
Dabbing is when they take a and I'm not saying this I know anything about because of my kids. I'm just saying the kids, speaking generally, although their mother might disagree. But you know, you take something that basically looks like a bong, you fill it up with a little bit of water, but now you take a blowtorch, a butane torch, and you light the bowl so it gets red hot. Then you take a dab of this extract, which is kind of gooey stuff. And you stick it in there and it instantly vaporizes. And then you pull the hit right through. And at one of these conferences we went to, one of the guys who spoke to us said, it's kind of like the equivalent of freebasing marijuana, what you're doing when you know, you're getting the super hit, the really hit, just in case a regular bong hit isn't enough. You can do it like this. And it's, you know, they just keep coming up with ways to make it more potent and deliver it more potent. But
yep. Very strong. Well,
we're a legal, we're a medical marijuana state. Although yes. I think there's a pretty good chance New Jersey's going to legalize at the end of the year. It's on the ballot in November. So I think they're definitely going to legalize it. And when that happens, like the biggest pot store in the world is going to be on the other side of the Ben Franklin Bridge. So that's going to be wide open. But I got my card in last fall, and I've been I really like these tinctures. That's the only thing I've gotten so far at the actual we bought a bunch of marijuana in Colorado and shipped it home. So we've had a bunch sitting around. But I've been getting these tinctures, and I love them. They're great. You know, you take a couple drops, and it's just – it. You know, I mean, I have, like, chronic anxiety. So, you know, a couple drops of that in the evening, and it just – you know, it doesn't make me wasted. I'm not, like, drooling all over my shirt, but it just sort of – it's just –
very discreet.
It makes you realize how much potential there is, because, you know, I'm like you, and until we went to Colorado a couple of years ago. I'd never been to a dispensary before that, and we walked into that dispensary, and I was amazed by all the cannabis products they had, and all that, you know, can calibrate it, and you can do all kinds of things that it's remarkable, and it's I'm really excited to, you know, to, I mean, it's like the best thing about now.
We should wrap this up by talking a little bit about the days between
Yeah.
between Jerry Garcia's birth and his passing.
Do you listen to the Grateful Dead station at all, Terry, the XM station?
I don't, but I do have re-listen on my phone.
Re-listen. Well, you know, this is the XM radio stations, which has now become pretty much my default radio station in the car. But somewhere along the way, you know, he was born on August 1st. He died on August 9th. Garcia.
So they created
this holiday, which ties into his song. It kind of gives that song of his a little new life and everything. And so they've kind of turned it into a mini Jerry holiday, you know, and they do a lot of stuff honoring him and everything. And Jim, you had a story you wanted to tell us about that, though, didn't you?
Well, I listened to John Mayer talk about chord changes. Dick's Picks won, Miami, Florida, 1973. Comes a Time. Was it? Or, you know, Here Comes Sunshine. Here Comes Sunshine.
Either one. Yep. Those are both great.
Really doing a deep dive into the chord changes and the back and forth between Jerry and Bob on that particular song. So I am enjoying listening to John Mayer's take, since he's obviously does a lot of studying of Jerry and the Grateful Dead for his gig with Dead & Company. But yeah, I'm enjoying the days between and listening to a lot of Jerry Garcia's solo stuff.
He would have been 78 years old.
I wonder if he would have made it.
I'm sorry?
It's remarkable how young he was when he died. I mean, he looked 10 years older, but I mean,
older than him now. But right. Yeah. It's crazy.
I know. Like a lot older.
and Phil is 80 and he's still playing.
I know.
Jerry was 53 when he died.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Who'd win a boxing match, Phil or Mick Jagger?
I'd put my money on Mick, but I don't know.
Well, he probably works out more. So
I was going to say, right, he's an animal, that guy. He moves around nobody's business. They're going to all just last forever. And, you know, can we all just, again, take note of the fact that Keith Richards is not only still alive, but like a functioning human being, which is just, you know.
How is it that the only like fully intact living 60s band is the Rolling Stones? Like, that makes no sense.
And they partied like nobody's business. It's
true. I mean, that was their shtick. Keith Richards had all his blood replaced.
Right. Right.
And that's true. Crazy.
Anyway, well, gentlemen, I think we're coming to the end of our time slot. It's been a great conversation.
Really has. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks
it's always great
me.
To catch up. Absolutely.
Nice to see you.
Do me one favor one more time before we get off. Give the email address, the webpage address again.
www.breakthroughvisuals.com, spelled just the way it sounds.
Okay.
Good. And for everybody who's listening and for all of Terry's friends out there, please encourage them to tune in and listen to our show.
I will. Yeah.
The more listeners, the better. We can, you know, get back on and tell all those great stories about all these guys. But it's more fun if they're listening while we're telling them.
Absolutely.
Very good. Okay. Well, I'm going to sign off from Denver, Colorado. Larry, you want to take us home?
I will, Jim. Thanks. Appreciate it. And I'll talk to you next week. Again, everybody, thanks for listening today. Our guest was Terry Laban. World famous Deadhead cartoonist, at least, you know, as far as we're concerned. Terry, thank you again for being on the show. Great to have you and be able to touch base with you again. And for all the listeners, stay healthy, stay safe. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Joyce Gerber, the creator and host of the award-winning podcast, The Canna Mom Show. And we are on a mission to enhance the impact women have on this industry as business professionals, healthcare providers, policy advocates, caregivers, moms, by sharing and preserving their stories of love and kindness, wisdom, and hope. I am so grateful to have found my tribe of Canna podcasters right here on PodConX, and look forward to our work of crushing the stigma around cannabis and caregivers. and building this new industry together.